Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, Friday mornings at 9. Join me as we explore topics like health and wellness, prosperity, inner peace, the law of attraction, and more. Tap into good vibrations to start your weekend feeling uplifted and optimistic. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Fridays from 9 to 10 a.m. on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver. Good morning. Welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I am your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you for joining me today. Today's guest is Karen Mazin Miller. She is the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life. Karen is an errant wife, delinquent mother, reluctant dog walker, and expert laundress, as well as a Zen Buddhist priest and teacher or sensei at the Hazy Moon Zen Center in Los Angeles, California. And she is here today to talk about her book, Hand Wash Cold, and how you can fall in love with the life that you already have. Welcome to the show, Karen.
Thank you, Marie.
Thanks for being with me today. So I interviewed you on Namaste Radio, and that was wonderful to speak with you, and I really enjoyed it. So I'm happy to have you here on Synchronicity today. And when I read your book, I just have to say that I found it very calming and soothing to read. It really tells a story. It's not one of those books that lays out all the steps that you need to do to make your life better. And so I'm just wondering, what inspired you to write Hand Wash Cold?
What inspired me to write Hand Wash Cold is actually an analogy for the message in Hand Wash Cold, and that is that We're always being given an opportunity in our life to do exactly what needs to be done. Specifically, what I'm telling you is that I was asked to write a book. I was asked to write a book about Zen in everyday life. And I'm not quite sure, even though I'm a practicing Zen Buddhist and a priest, I'm not quite sure what anyone means when they say, write a book about Zen in everyday life, because Zen is everyday life. The practice of Zen is removing the about, which is the way we conceptualize and intellectualize our life, you know, the way we think it about it and overthink it, analyze it, measure it, evaluate it. So I was asked to write a book about Zen in everyday life, and the truth is that the only life I had to work with was my own. Otherwise, I'd just be making stuff up. And there are a lot of books on the shelf of moderate helpfulness. Some are really quite helpful. You know, particularly cookbooks are helpful if you want to produce something that comes out of it. But that are more about the about than the life. You know, here are other ways that you can go about achieving something. So I simply responded to the request, and my point. And the larger point in the book is that we're so, for the most part, confused about what we should be doing in our life and how, you know, we should be manufacturing and changing and transforming, and how can we possibly arrive at a life of greater meaning and purpose. And my point is that we're always being shown, we're always being told, we're always being led exactly in the direction that we need to go. It's always right in front of our face. So that's the long version of the story.
Wonderful. Well, before we get more into your book, Hand Wash Cold, I just want to say, I forgot to say that this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and you may also be listening online at citr.ca, cosmicdimensions.com, empowerradio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network. So wherever you're joining us from, thanks for being with us today, or even if you're listening to this on podcast after the fact, thank you for tuning in. So, Karen, I'm wondering what led you to become a Zen Buddhist priest? I mean, what, you know, a lot of us are ingrained with religious views by our parents or by society. What kind of sparked your interest in Zen Buddhism?
Yes. Well, it's the kind of thing that actually creates growth and transformation in anyone's life, and that is, it was a series of catastrophic events.
Okay.
You know, we kind of have to break open, through some force or another before we might actually change the path that we're headed into. And I, first I can tell you that I never felt that I was particularly spiritually endowed. You know, I was raised as a good Lutheran girl, which means that I was neither good nor Lutheran. But my mother was a woman of deep faith, deep Christian faith, and she did what I think most of us want to do with our children in particular, and that is to lead them in the path of righteousness. And so I did have spiritual training growing up, and I simply felt, I think, as many people do, more power to you if you don't have this as a child. I just feel that indoctrination is probably not a very effective way to introduce spirituality into our children's lives.
Well, Karen, it's interesting how you said you had spiritual training through the Lutheran background. And I was raised Catholic and was exposed to various denominations of Christianity as I was growing up. And I didn't really see that there was a whole lot very spiritual about it. It was all like fear-based and...
Well, you're very right. And I probably misused the word. I'll say religious training.
Okay.
And religious training is doctrinal training. And essentially that's what any organized, institutionalized religion has to offer. Because the practice component, the personal practice component, can be very, very weak in our Western traditions. And so we have people who talk the talk but don't walk the talk, a lot of admonitions and prohibitions, a lot of debate and self-righteousness about what is the right view versus the wrong view, et cetera, et cetera. So I learned the catechism, so to speak.
Okay.
I learned that. I could recite it. And I think that's what, for most of us, as children, what religious training consists of. And it just didn't take. But that doesn't mean that wasn't troubling for me at all, because I think until you reach, there's a point in your life that's waiting for you mm-hmm. when you will finally need to have a well of spiritual guidance and consolation for yourself. And at the time that I needed that, I had nothing. You know, for the most part, you know, when not everybody's life is like this, but, you know, I did, I was a good student, I graduated from university, I got a good job, I got a better job, I was married, I had got a home, I got a bigger home, I got money, I got more money, I got more things. And when you're on that kind of, sometimes it can be a very short, or maybe it's a very long path, you don't think you need spirituality, because everything's kind of working for you. And I can remember looking at people who were religious or who had faith as being kind of people who didn't have as much going on for them as I did, you know, kind of looking down my nose at them. So obviously I was devoting myself to a life that is guaranteed to be unfulfilling.
So Karen, I'm curious, in your seeking out material things and the bigger house and the bigger career and all of that, was it just because that's what we do as a society? That's what's expected of us? Or were you seeking something to fulfill you?
Not consciously. I mean, you can look and see how the way we live as sentient beings, I mean, the way that the trajectory of the human life, On a very superficial level, we can say, oh my goodness, we live in a consumer culture, and therefore we are conditioned to always, want more and always be seeking. And it's so interesting that the word fulfillment has fill in it. We're always seeking to be filled. And this is true not just in the way we consume things and our desires, but in our relationships. Isn't it the case that we're thinking that there's some other person there who can make us feel fulfilled, can make us feel whole? So on a superficial level, we can say, yes, that's just what we do, isn't it? I mean, and that is you know, essentially the path that most of us are going to find ourselves on, and we're going to have either a very false sense of momentary satisfaction and gratification, or we're going to have a false sense of failure. But those feelings are false, because the goal that we have in mind is superficial and elusive. But the deeper aspect is that, of course, our behaviors all come from a deeper spiritual yearning. I mean, and only when you kind of get to the other side can you reflect and say, oh my goodness, everything that we do in life, this seeking, you know, this filling, this hunger that we have, comes from this deeper spiritual yearning that we have. And so some of us are, you know, reach a point where we really do start to deal with that on a spiritual level, and many of us, most of us, never do. But if you really take a look at most of the, we could call them neuroses, or maybe they're even psychoses, most of the illnesses in modern times are really cases where we over indulge. That's that constant seeking to fill. And we have to keep doing it because, of course, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. So anyway, approaching my middle age, I had amassed a life that was doomed to fall and crumble, because it was built on, you know, my own self-service, flimsy ideals, and no real substance. And I just entered a point where my marriage failed, my relationships failed. I no longer had the same devotion to my work ethic that had propelled me. And I was sitting in the middle of the life that I'd always had, feeling as though it wasn't my own, that I'd never even really had a life, because I'd never reached that one day that I thought all of my happiness would arrive. It had never happened.
And so, Karen, I'm curious, because when we talk about being fulfilled, we were talking about how, especially in relationships, we seek out someone to fulfill us. But the irony of that is that if we are not full ourselves, the relationship's never going to work.
Absolutely. But I'll tell you this, relationships don't work. Relationships by nature don't work in the way that we, like, you know, most of us, when we think a relationship is working, what we really mean is it's working for us. It's going my way. It's working for me. I think, you know, it is ironic, and yet it's also, once again, a very profound spiritual opportunity. The relationship, an intimate relationship, and by that I simply mean proximity. You're living in proximity to anything is going to rub you in a difficult way. You're going to have to deal with things that you don't like, events that you don't like, feelings, thoughts, points of view that you don't agree with. And that's the great opportunity in a relationship. It doesn't work. And so then it can actually begin to work on you by making you examine really what's not working. And what's not working in a relationship is that we cannot allow things to be as they are. We're always thinking that they have to be serviced in a particular way, you know, deliver to us what we need and want. So there's great, great opportunity in every relationship, precisely because they don't work. But yeah, we're not going to find fulfillment in another. We're going to find that, yes, we have to make ourselves round and whole, complete, by allowing everything and everyone to be who they are and what they are. You know, that's the great gift in a spiritual practice, is that you can really have intimate relationships, because you're no longer imposing your own expectations on another. And I won't say no longer. It just means when you catch yourself, you see yourself more clearly, all the expectations that you impose on other people and other circumstances in order to deliver you to a place that you simply like more than another.
Well, beautifully said. It's time for a break now, so we'll be back with more synchronicity in a moment. We are speaking today with Karen Mazin Miller. She is the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life. The topic of today's show is falling in love with the life you already have, which is also the topic of her book, Hand Wash Cold. I'm Marie Bernard. This is Synchronicity, and we'll be back in a moment.
Strength.
Dignity.
Respect.
Beauty.
Self-worth.
Safety.
Confidence.
Choice.
Hope.
The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives. This is the
first day of Through its popular makeover program, the Beauty Night Society has touched the lives of thousands and reintroduced a healthy touch to the lives of vulnerable women throughout British Columbia, creating real life makeovers.
Please visit www.beautynight.org for information on programs and on how to help. Beauty Night, because dignity is beautiful. I think I was blind before I met you.
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support the Enchanted Evenings concert series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden in Vancouver. The series runs from July 9th to September 3rd every Friday evening. Come and enjoy a diverse array of world music while sampling food selected specifically to complement the music. Of the series' 9 concerts, the first 4 are in July.
On July 9th, the series kicks off with the Birds of Paradox, combining Western Chinese and Indian music. Delana Gail Bowen with her sultry blues, jazz, and gospel on July 16th, Ocean of Sound with their percussion-based music on July 23rd, and the Vancouver Piano Ensemble on July 30th.
Tickets are $20 and $18 for garden members. A season's pass is only $135, with a savings of $45.
For tickets and information, call 604-662-3207, extension 210, and visit VancouverChineseGarden.com for a full listing of upcoming concerts. The Enchanted Evenings concert series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden in Vancouver, every Friday from July 9th to September 3rd.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm Marie Bernard, and next week we are going to be speaking with celebrity numerologist Tanya Gabrielle. So tune in for that if you want to get a mini numerology reading on the air next week. And if you'd like to get on the air today and speak with our guest Karen Mazin Miller, the number to call is 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487. She's the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life, and she is a Zen Buddhist priest and teacher at the Hazy Moon Zen Center in Los Angeles, California. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Thank you.
So I'm curious, why do you think it is that people are so unfulfilled or unsatisfied with their lives?
I think it's inevitable, frankly, and I don't think it's a modern kind of dilemma. As long as we live, in fact, although I don't often like to quote Buddhist quotations, you probably gathered that from reading. I try to keep things as accessible and ordinary as possible. Buddha said the only difference between an enlightened being and a sentient being or a human being is upside-down thinking. We simply live our lives confused. We believe that we are separate from the place we occupy. We have a notion, it's really just a notion, that we as individuals, you know, I think that I am separate from the room in which I sit, you know, the world that I occupy. I believe that I'm separate from you. And whenever we come from that point of view, that point of division or separation, it's called ignorance in a spiritual sense. It doesn't mean stupid. It means that we are simply deluded and we live in opposition to the life that we actually have. You know, you're the only one in your life. You never leave your life. You wake every morning in the middle of your universe. And yet, don't you always feel as though there's something you're supposed to get? That you might even be in competition with the world around you to get your fair share, or even more than your fair share? That you should be better off, that you should be happier, that something, some series of events needs to happen in order to deliver you to a point where you feel what? That you've arrived? So this is a persistent illusion that we live with. And, of course, we cannot satisfy a feeling of shorthandedness that is itself an illusion. So we're fated to feel this way until we simply correct our point of view and realize that the life we're living is itself us, that we are inseparable from our lives. We're inseparable from the place in which we live. Everything that surrounds us, that appears to surround us, is ours, and we're responsible for it. And at that point, now, this may come in a flash of insight. In my case, it comes with deep and prolonged committed practice that I realize that I have everything. I lack nothing. And so, you know, where's my problem? That's all spiritual traditions are, different evocations, different manifestations of this journey that we feel compelled to take because it is our birthright. And so instead of treating this yearning, this wistful longing that we have with more things, more money, more food, sometimes more shopping, you know, more mates, a different this, a better that, we instead enter into a life of practice in which we over and over simply correct and redirect our point of view so that we can see that we lack nothing.
And so that's so beautifully said. Thank you so much, Karen. I think that's maybe one of the, because we talk about how, I mean, you mentioned that you have everything. And the first thing that came to mind is like, well, what about the person who's homeless? Or what about the person living in, you know, a developing country who, by our standards, really doesn't have much at all? Yet, when you go to a place like India, where there are many people living very poorly, generally they're much happier than we are here.
You know, that's a phenomenon that's observed over and over and over again, and yet we just don't get it. Now, that doesn't mean that their lives can't be materially enhanced. Of course they can. And, but first I'll say that very question, you see, the formulation of that very question is what I'm talking about. We go up into our heads and we say, but wait a minute, what about? We're constantly engaging in this intellectual. You see how we even remove ourselves from, I don't know what your situation is right now, but presumably your eyes are open. And you say, okay, well, for the purpose of discussion, for the purpose of debate, let me create a hypothetical. Now, does that work in that situation? And, you know, here, what I'm trying to point to is that we live our whole lives in a hypothetical situation. We're always going back into our heads saying, okay, well, I know she's telling me that I should be satisfied with what I am. However, what about this? And you see, that is that judging, evaluating, measuring, non-stop commentary inside our heads that, frankly, is the source of our suffering. It not only makes us perhaps more worried and concerned with what-if scenarios, but all the scenario that we're really concerned with, we might from time to time be concerned with the homeless man or woman on the corner, but really what we're concerned with is our own grasping nature. I can't speak for anyone but myself, but this is what I can do. If you want to talk about really how to put compassion in action, how to really spread love and peace, when I drive by the homeless man or walk by the homeless man, can I look at him or her with no judgment, no worry about how they got into that situation or where they're going to go from here? Can I simply see what's in front of me and reach into my pocketbook and hand that person something that I have that they might need, money, and can I have no concern with how they use it? That's what I'm talking about, to be able to really see and live a life that is free from our own grasping, clutching, worried, what-if minds. What we're talking about here is really not, we're talking about something much deeper than the way things appear. We're talking about a much deeper relationship to your life than just, okay, I get it, it's just how it is. A much deeper, where you can see that through the illusion of life and see that how much capacity you have, how much wisdom and compassion you already have, how to live differently in the life where you are right now and as it is right now. And the truth is you find that you can do a lot of things that you think that you can't do.
Well, thank you so much, Karen. It's time for another break. We are speaking with Karen Mazin-Miller. She is the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life. She is a Zen Buddhist priest in Los Angeles, California. And we will be back with more synchronicity in a moment. I'm Marie Bernard. Thanks for being with me today.
Rude boys, don't cry, don't cry.
Rude boy, don't cry.
Rude is ska music. You make me dance all night. Ska music, you're all right.
TC The Drive, every Friday morning, 10 a.m. till noon, CITR.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. This is Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you for joining us today. And we are speaking with Karen Mazin-Miller. She's the author of Hand Wash Cold. If you would like to get on the air and ask her a question, the number to call is 604-822-2487. That's 604-822-2487. Welcome back to the show, Karen.
Thank you.
So I want to jump into the actual, we've been talking about some wonderful things, and I really want to focus on your book, though, because it is such a lovely book. So it's separated into, what, three sections. So the first one is the laundry, and it's interesting. It's the laundry. To study the way is to study oneself. And in the book, you talk about how the laundry is one of the things that when you were in your time of getting more and focusing on financial stuff, that you thought the laundry was beneath you.
Yes. I thought most of my life was beneath me, you know, the kind of housekeeping things. So I had, there's, frankly, a lot of us feel this way, that there's just the minutia in our lives is more than we can handle, that we want to focus on other things. But inherent in that is that we really view our time as money, and we want to make the best use of it. So I had somebody do my laundry for 15 years. I never touched a stitch of it. There's nothing really wrong with that. I mean, to tell you the truth, I don't want to suggest that, that there's some merit or value in only doing your laundry by yourself. I just felt like it was representative of how aloof and adrift, how alienated I was from my own life. I had a house that essentially I didn't live in. I had a home that I didn't keep. And so I kind of had my life at arm's distance. But that first section, laundry, you can say that these are metaphorical distinctions, but they're also not metaphors, because when we do our laundry, we come into intimate engagement with our own lives. We see the aspects of ourselves mainly that we might like to not see. You know, maybe they're stinky, unpleasant, unattractive, And it's that self-examination that is the first stage of every spiritual journey. So that's what that quotation refers to study the way is to study yourself. The first stage of any spiritual quest or journey is to really examine yourself. And that's what we do in seated meditation. It's self-examination. We're studying ourselves. That doesn't mean analyzing ourselves as in a psychotherapeutic approach where we revisit the past over and over again, attempting to somehow understand our past or create a storyline about it. It means studying it and seeing that my own view of my life is my source of unhappiness, that I'm my problem, not really anyone else. The second stage is the kitchen, what I refer to as the kitchen. This is what happened to me.
Can I interrupt you for a second, Karen? Because you were talking about studying yourself, and also the line is to study the way is to study oneself. So what is the way?
Yeah, the way is, we might say it in Buddhism, and we might call it the Buddha way or Zen. It means the spiritual life, to study the truth. And no matter what kind of a spiritual tradition that we're in, that's what we're studying. We are aiming to study or learn how to live differently. You know, how to be different, how to experience our lives in a different way.
And then, thank you for that. And then you were going to talk about the kitchen.
Yeah, next we move into the kitchen, which I parallel to the second stage in the spiritual journey, which is to study the self. We've just done that in the laundry, is to forget the self. Now, it doesn't mean what we have in the Western world is kind of this people, you know, we analyze ourselves to kingdom come. We never stop taking a look and redefining who it is we say we and think we are. But in a spiritual journey, the next important step is to stop doing that. Stop only serving yourself. And this is the source of compassion. Compassion is selfless. So I marry that, literally, to the kitchen. Where in my home, as an errant wife and delinquent mother, the kitchen is the heart of not just my home, but the heart of my life and the heart of my relationships. Because that's where I'm pressed to come into service of what we were talking about earlier, the relationships that don't work. You know, not every day is, you know, a honeymoon. And so where is it in my life that I work through those feelings of perhaps resentment or recrimination, the reluctance that I might feel to actually still be living in service of my family in the kitchen, where we prepare things, food that nourishes life, and we nourish others. So that's what happens in the kitchen. It's washing the dishes and making breakfast and cleaning up after others without any of that kind of backlash that we often bring to it. Well, I didn't make this mess. You know, I shouldn't have to do this. And it's interesting. Now, Marie, don't you think? I mean, I know here I have friends who have elaborate kitchens and no one does any cooking. So once again, we've created homes that are really, we're with vacancy in them. We feel this sense of vacancy in our own lives.
So where do they go to restaurants?
Yeah, either that or you know, they take out. I think that there's not as much, although people appreciate the culinary arts as a pastime and as a hobby, I think that to a large degree, the tradition of a family meal is lost. Yeah, it's lost. And yet it's so essential. I think it's so essential. On the one hand, whoever cooks the meal is cooking selflessly because it's serving another. The time and the place is something else that's very lost in our homes, and that is company with one another. Time actually spent with one another when we're not preoccupied by our gadgets. So that's very rare.
That's interesting because I noticed I used to have a boyfriend who I would spend a lot of time with, and we would always watch TV. And I was always saying, like, we don't spend time together. You know, we're not interacting. And he'd be like, what are you talking about? We're always together. We're always watching TV. And I'm like, yeah, but we're in the same room staring at this idiot box, but we're not.
You're in the same room, but not in the same room.
But we're not together, yeah.
And I noticed you said used to have that boyfriend.
Yeah.
Well, you know, these are things that it's not as though we create. I've created this perfect kind of life. That's what I have to practice with, that very thing that I have to practice with. I have to keep bringing myself into the room and inviting everyone to join me. That's my job as a homemaker, whether somebody has to make a home, whether it's me as the wife and mother or whether it's my husband. Very often it's the children who really provide the galvanizing force so that a home can be made, you know, with greater sincerity by the parents and, you know, to support the children. But somebody has to do that. Somebody has to keep, well, somebody has to turn off the TV. Somebody has to turn off the computer and the phones. You know, sometimes what happens, you can watch yourself do this mindlessly. You sit down at a table together, and what's the first thing people do? Reach for a magazine and open it up. Because even though you're sitting at a table, you're not actually going to share your mind space with someone else. So that all happens in the kitchen, and that's what I try to talk through. Not in a lofty spiritual nature, you know, but just in terms of grounded in how life really is in a modern kitchen. How is it really today? That's what that's all I have to work with.
And so, Karen, I want to talk about the third part of the book, The Yard, to forget oneself is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. And your yard, you actually have an interesting, you had an interesting gardener that you hired.
Sam. Yes, we did have a gardener, yeah. And you know, I have a wonderful backyard that is California's oldest private Japanese garden, a garden that was built 100 years ago, which is, of course, why I, with my interest in Zen and Buddhism, was drawn to this place and acquired it. But when my husband and I moved here, we felt quite inadequate and insufficient to the task of caring for something that we imagined to be so precious. And this is a feeling that most of us have about different aspects of our lives. Well, we can't do that. I'll never be able to do this. Who's going to take care of that? That feeling of inadequacy and insufficiency that often keeps us hindered and hampered, you know, from living a life of greater dimension. So, of course, we went looking for an expert gardener. And we were recommended, we were given the name of a gentleman whose first name was Sam, and he was said to be a Japanese gardener. And he came to our home, and we immediately endowed him with complete responsibility for a yard. This is something else that we often do. Do you notice this? Not just with gardeners. We keep looking for the experts, maybe the guru or the teacher, someone who knows more than we do, and we're going to give them responsibility. Oftentimes, this is what happens in a spiritual journey. I find a teacher, and I'm just going to bequeath them complete responsibility for my life. And that's easily abused, isn't it? But over time, we watched Sam with greater and greater concern because we noticed that he really didn't seem to have any expertise. He made egregious mistakes and oversights, and yet he loved spending time in the garden. He would spend whole days here with this impish grin on his face. And we were mortified when we saw some of the things that he did because we came to realize, like I said, that he really wasn't a Japanese gardener. In other words, he wasn't a gardener of Japanese gardens. He was a little Japanese fellow who happened to be a gardener. You know, common mistake, especially when we go looking for the expertise we think we don't have. But he did teach us something, and everything Sam cared for thrived because Sam gave everything his love and attention. He didn't need to be an expert. He simply gave his loving attention, his devoted gaze, his time. He invested his time in the garden. And so what we thought at first were horrible mistakes ended up being just fine. And so Sam taught me the power of my own attention. And whatever I put my attention to, that's love, the purest form of love, and it will thrive. And that's what we bring into our yard. That is the world that surrounds us. Whether your backyard is a mishmash, you know, of weeds and refuse, or whether it's this pristine garden, it's your world. We bring our attention to the world, and we transform the world in which we live. The same way we bring our non-judgmental attention, the homeless man on the corner, you know, to the weeds in the front yard, the neighbor that we might have a little bit of a prickly relationship with. We bring our own attention to it, to our communities, to our neighbors, to our world. And we turn, what I say, a patch of pavement into paradise.
Mm, nice. And so we're talking about how we can really tune in and connect, yet, you know, we're still these people who are always up in our heads. And so I'm going to ask you this question, and I don't know if it's going to be like, what? I've just been telling you this.
Oh, no, please.
What are some of the, what's the first physical step? Because we like to have steps.
Oh,
we have a recipe.
Yes.
So what's the first ingredient in the recipe to loving the life that you have?
Well, there's not just the first ingredient. There's only one ingredient. You have to practice. And that means you have to have a spiritual practice. Now, when I say, you say, oh my gosh, what is a practice? Well, in my tradition, it's very clear. I practice seated meditation. If I didn't practice seated meditation, which is what the Buddha taught, which is what every image of Buddha is still teaching, you notice, every image of Buddha is a seated Buddha for the most part, still teaching that to sit down following the breath, our own breath, liberates you from that firestorm in your mind, those thoughts and feelings that you can't get out of. It's essential that you do that. The critical vehicle that's employed is the breath itself, something you don't need to know. No doctrine, no dogma, no mantra, no mystery. Now, that very same vehicle is used in all spiritual traditions. That's what we do in yoga, right? You use the breath to unify the body and the mind. That's what we do in chanting. That's what we do in prayer. Every Western and Eastern tradition alike has a contemplative aspect that practices. So, and you might say, oh gosh, well, you know, I'm not a nun or a monk. I can't do this. Yes, you can. You can do it for 5 minutes a day. You can sit in a chair. You can get a zafu, a cushion. These things, you go on the internet, Marie, you know this. I mean, you can turn up 10 billion sites that tell you how to meditate. It's almost as though people, you know, might say, well, how do I floss my teeth? Everyone knows how to floss their teeth, but do they? It takes 15 seconds. So, yes, without a seated practice, a practice of seated meditation, I couldn't talk the way I talk. I couldn't live the way I live. I wouldn't see what I see. If I didn't practice on a cushion in my bedroom or at the Zen Center where I practice, I couldn't practice standing at the sink. I would just still be one more raging egomaniac. And believe me, enough days of the week I am. I practice so for at least a moment I can be free of that and liberate all the people around me from my own, you know, lunacy. So that's essential. We have to have a practice. And you know, discipline is just a touchy subject. But discipline, self-discipline, is the foundation of all spiritual practices and journeys. Without it, you're just going to wander around in your head thinking that there's something, some secret, you know, some quick fix, some certain belief system that's going to liberate you. No, you really have to liberate yourself. So I don't have to tell you. I mean, I'm sure where anybody is, they can find, it's not difficult to find information. What is lacking is the initiative to really take a step. Find a meditation group that you can, or a practice center. Go to a yoga class. It's all going to lead you in a direction that will enhance and liberate your life because it's your path.
Wonderful. And it's interesting what you said about we can all find the information. I mean, the information isn't the problem. It's we almost have too much information.
We have so much information that we can get addicted to information. That's just yet another one of our addictions. We think, you know, essentially now with our computers and the internet, we have, you know, the Library of Congress. We have a world, the world's largest library, you know, in our bedrooms, you know, or on our office or study or on the kitchen table. Yeah. So that's actually, it's something that we have to overcome. We have to overcome the hunger for information, and we have to replace it with the desperation, really, to take a step, really the motivation to take a step. You will be guided. That's just the other thing. You don't have to chart the course. Your life is the course. By hearing this, in my case, you know, speaking of synchronicity, I found a book on my very own bookshelf that had been left behind for me. I had not placed it there. That was how my journey started. Everyone's journey starts with that, with a moment of synchronicity. Yeah, you don't have to plan it. Isn't that a relief?
Yeah.
You already have a ticket. You just have to board the train.
But I'm so good at planning everything.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's what you think is your great strength, of course, is your great weakness.
Yeah. Wonderfully said. Well, it's time for another break. So we are speaking with Karen Mazin Miller. She is the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life. Fall in love with the life that you already have. We'll be back with more synchronicity in just a second.
CITR 101.9 FM is proud to support the Enchanted Evenings Concert Series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden in Vancouver. The series runs from July 9th to September 3rd every Friday evening. Come and enjoy a diverse array of world music while sampling food selected specifically to complement the music. Of the series' 9 concerts, the first 4 are in July.
On July 9th, the series kicks off with the Birds of Paradox. Combining Western Chinese and Indian music, Delana Gail Bowen with her sultry blues, jazz, and gospel on July 16th, Ocean of Sound with their percussion-based music on July 23rd, and the Vancouver Piano Ensemble on July 30th.
Tickets are $20 and $18 for Garden members. A season's pass is only $135, with a savings of $45.
For tickets and information, call 604-662-3207, extension 210, and visit VancouverChineseGarden.com for a full listing of upcoming concerts. The Enchanted Evenings Concert Series at the Dr. Sun Yat-sen Classical Chinese Garden in Vancouver, every Friday from July 9th to September 3rd.
Welcome back to Synchronicity Talk Radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard. Thank you so much for being with us today. Coming up in about 10 minutes is Scotty's Scenic Drive, so stick around for that. And next week on Synchronicity, we're going to be speaking with Tanya Gabrielle. She is the celebrity numerologist. She's very well known if you travel in the circles of numerology, and she does do a lot of readings for celebrities, and she's going to be here talking about numerology and hopefully doing some mini readings on the air. So if you're interested in numbers and what all of that means, definitely tune in next Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific time here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. So today we are speaking with Karen Mazin Miller. She is the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life that you can fall in love with today, right now, enjoying the life you already have. She is a Zen Buddhist priest, and here she is. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
So we just have a few minutes left in the show, and I wanted to ask you, because you mentioned this, and I like to ask everyone, because sometimes people say, you know, oh, I meditate and now my life is perfect and I'm always, you know, I'm always kind and I never make a mistake. So, and you mentioned that you're still an egomaniac at times. So I like your honesty, and I'm just wondering, can you share a little bit about that and how, what your experience has been?
Sure. Well, you know, we don't sprout wings, you know, with our practice. you know, what the practice does, what any practice does, is bring us to a point of clarity. And by and let's not get fancy about what clarity is. It just means we see things. And since the source of all of our difficulty, you know, is when we don't like the way things are. You know, we just don't like it. We say, I just can't handle it. I can't handle it right now. I don't deserve this. I need more. I mean, I. You hear that? I always me. So what practice does is it just shows you how whenever we go in, enter into that stream, that nonstop me, we're going to arrive at a place of deep dissatisfaction and difficulty. And it's actually called suffering, is what we call it, which is the first noble truth. But that doesn't mean that we, like I said, become robotic, indifferent, automatons, you know, we don't become inhuman. No. What we see is more fully the whole range, the full catastrophe of our lives at all times. But literally, what I mean is I'll give you this example. This is what I share with people when I lead retreats. And people can come away and spend a day in a retreat that I will lead, and they will feel wonderful during that time. The calm descends, you know. They, in particular, when we're at a distance from our loved ones, we love them even more. We might feel very open-hearted.
Yeah, and then we get close to them.
Very calm, you know, yes, and refreshed. And maybe we can't wait to get home. And I tell you this, Marie, I've been practicing nearly 20 years, and this is what I have to keep very much in front of me as I'm cruising back up the highway to come back to my house, pulling into the driveway. When I open the door to my home, I need to have the presence of mind so that I do not immediately react to the scene in front of me. Because it's not going to be quite the way I would have done it. And I tell people when they come home from a retreat, back into the space where essentially all their loved ones are, not to let the first thing out of their mouth be this: who made this mess? You see, just by walking into a place with that attitude, I'm imposing a judgment. I'm distancing myself. I'm setting blame. I'm expressing my dissatisfaction. You see, that's the kind of thing. And how often do we do that? Do we do it constantly, every day, where we walk into an environment with that kind of a judgment, that kind of, to assess blame, to fix, to correct, to adjudicate, to punish? You see, we're doing that, for the most part, constantly. So if I can walk into a place one time and not bring that with me, I've planted peace in that place. I've let the space open up. I have liberated my loved ones from my own ego mania, my wrath, and my judgment. It's that simple. If I can do that. Now, can I do that every time? No. When I mess up, when I lose my temper, when I rage on and on, I have the means. It's called atonement. It's in every tradition. I have the means to restore harmony. In two words, once again, it's the breath, a quick gust. I'm sorry. I can atone when I have caused disturbance in this place, this yard, the garden, the world that we share. When I bring my own ego judgment to it and cause others to recoil, you know, from my imposition on it, I can create peace, restore peace right there. Now, does it mean that the dishes are always done the way I like them to be? No. Does it mean the room's always straightened the way I like it to be? No. Does it mean that everything happens according to my agenda? Absolutely not. It never does, and it never will. And only I can liberate myself from my own hard-heartedness, my own agenda, through my own example. Then I might be able to teach others to selflessly, joyfully, you know, take responsibility for the place that we share. That's the most I can do and the best I can offer to people. So that's a living example of, you know, your spiritual practice has to work when you walk in the door of your own home. And then if it works there, then it can work when you walk out of the door of your own home. Works both ways.
Well, thank you so much, Karen, for being with us today. Again, your book is Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life. And we're just about out of time. I'm wondering if there's anything that you would like to add.
What I like to say in parting is that having a good life is simple when you savor the one you have. And that's really the message that I want to impart, you know, that for the most part, we have, well, not even for the most part, where our lives are so full, so rich, so well, so endowed. Happiness is our birthright, really. And all we have to do is make a turn in a different direction, looking inside instead of outside, and we'll find it. We'll find it.
Beautifully said. Thank you so much, Karen Mazin Miller. Have a wonderful day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So again, that was Karen Mazin Miller, the author of Hand Wash Cold, Care Instructions for an Ordinary Life. Thank you for being with us today. Next week, again, is Tanya Gabrielle. She is the celebrity numerologist, so check back with us next week. Up in a moment is Scotty's Scenic Drive. Thank you so much for being with us today. I hope you enjoyed the show and have a wonderful day, a wonderful weekend. Namaste.